From Hurricane Sandy to Hurricane Irma, sea level rise is driving storm surges higher and higher. But what if that storm surge is permanent?
I knew I was going to write about this in some way, and I talked to a climate scientist at Columbia, and he said, you know, one way to think about this is as a dress rehearsal for sea level rise. And I said, well, what do you mean? And he said, well, 9 feet of sea level rise is sort of the high end of what we think might be possible for the end of the century. So imagine that storm surge that was Hurricane Sandy came in, but never went out.
That's Jeff Cadell. We talk with him about his new book, The Water Will Come, Rising Seas, Sinking Cities, and the Remaking of the Civilized World. Then, as coastal properties go underwater, will governments, businesses, and homeowners sue? We talk with Lynn Zinser of the nonprofit journalism website Climate Liability News about the legal implications of climate change. That's all coming up on today's Writer's Voice. Thanks for joining us this hour on this station and at writersvoice.net. I'm your host, Francesca Rihanna. Sea level rise projections just keep getting worse. They've gone from about 3 feet by 2100 now to as much as 9 feet. And we don't have to wait until the end of the century to see the waters rising. Storm surges are higher, and sunny day flooding is already happening in places like Miami Beach as tides push up out of storm drains and sewers. And like so many other things in our wildly unequal society, the impact will fall much more heavily on the 90%. The wealthy will suffer some affordable losses. But what about those who rent or whose homes hold the most, if not all, the equity they own? People whose jobs depend on their communities not washing away. As we saw after Hurricane Harvey in Houston, they'll be out of luck. In his book, The Water Will Come, journalist Jeff Cadell describes the toll sea level rise is already taking around the world and lays out sober predictions of its future damages. But there are things we can do to moderate its impact. Stop emitting carbon, for starters. But we can also retreat from the coast and learn to live better with the water. The Water Will Come is an important book about the clear and present danger of sea level rise, but it's also a hopeful one. Jeff Cadell writes for Rolling Stone magazine and is a fellow at the New America Foundation. His previous books include Big Coal and How to Cool the Planet. Jeff Cadell, welcome to Writer's Voice.
Thanks for having me.
This is, I think this is the book I've been waiting for to read. The Water Will Come, Rising Seas, Sinking Cities, and the Remaking of the Civilized World. That's so interesting, that last part of your subtitle, Remaking the Civilized World?
Yeah, it's a little grand, right? but, you know, I actually think it's true. I mean, you know, much of our life right now is increasingly centered around coastlines. Coastal cities are growing and growing and growing. And, you know, we love living on water and or near water. And what's happening now with sea level rise is going to force us to rethink that in a very profound way. So that's why we have a subtitle like that.
It's kind of optimistic.
Well, you know, one critic called this book strangely optimistic, and I might call it very strangely optimistic, but I think it is, in its own way, optimistic. I think that even with fast rising seas, we can rethink how we live on coastlines. And it doesn't mean that, you know, we can't live near water or anything like that. I just think it means that we have to think about it in a profoundly different way.
Right. And I really hope your book becomes a book that changes the way we do things. So you start it with a little speculative fiction. You start it with the Miami hurricane of 2037. Tell us what happens.
Well, I started it, you know, thinking, trying to sort of imagine the near future, just to imagine, you know, a little bit like what we saw kind of coming up the coast with Hurricane Irma recently, but imagining a Category 5 hurricane hitting Miami after you've already had, you know, a foot or two of sea level rise, and what a difference that makes. And, you know, the imagined hurricane in the book really tries to underscore how different it will be, in the sense that not only will there be higher water, so that there will be an increasing amount of water in the city, the storm surge will be all that much bigger, but there'll be questions then about rebuilding. Once we really process into our kind of, you know, collective national psyche that sea level rise is real, that it's happening, and that it could be happening fast, much faster than we think, I think it's going to change how we think about rebuilding after hurricanes. So I talk about that. I talk about how, you know, the president, the imagined president, comes out and says, you know, we're going to rebuild better and stronger than ever before, like every political leader does after a big hurricane hits a city. But it never quite happens. And Miami, as we know it today in this fictional scenario, sort of slowly declines, and people don't rebuild back. And, you know, there's a lot of abandoned houses and structures, and, you know, alligators move in, and, you know, you have a whole different kind of, the political system breaks down. And you, by the end of the century, I kind of imagine Miami as a kind of a water world, you know, where I talk about people, you know, sort of scuba diving to see barnacled SUVs and things like that. And, you know, my goal was to try to really provoke people into thinking about what this really means.
Yeah, exactly. And I think a real theme of the book, as we'll see as this conversation unfolds, is kind of the difference between what we could do and what we're likely to do given political and economic constraints. But let's get into the meat of it. Now, a different hurricane than the one of 2037 obviously got you started, and that was Sandy. So tell us how Sandy was a wake-up call for you.
Yeah, so this book really started with Sandy. You know, I have been writing about climate change and energy policy for 15 years, and I certainly knew about sea level rise, and I had talked to, you know, great scientists like James Hansen at NASA, the kind of godfather of global warming science. And, you know, I knew about it in the way that most people kind of who pay attention to this issue know about it. It's just sort of as something that, you know, one among many issues that, you know, were worrisome when you think about, you know, our rapidly changing climate. And then Hurricane Sandy hit, and I wasn't in New York the day it hit, but I was nearby, and I came into Lower Manhattan the day after, and, you know, I saw what the water had done, and it was just kind of mind blowing, in a, you know, to see, you know, this great city that I had spent so much time in, you know, just devastated by this storm surge. And, you know, 9 feet of water had come into Lower Manhattan, and, you know, there was blackouts, and, you know, I watched people carrying, you know, wet furniture out of their houses, and cars were still had water in them, and, you know, there was water lines on all the buildings, and it was just a kind of devastation. And I knew I was going to write about this in some way, and I talked to a climate scientist at Columbia, and he said, you know, one way to think about this is as a dress rehearsal for sea level rise. And I said, well, what do you mean? And he said, well, 9 feet of sea level rise is sort of the high end of what we think might be possible for the end of the century. So imagine that storm surge that was Hurricane Sandy came in, but never went out. And I was like, wow, that's a very powerful idea. And he said, well, you want to really think about it, you know, go have that same thought in Miami. And I was like, why? And he said, go and you'll see. And so I did. And, you know, that's where the book really began, because I really understood for all the risks that for cities like New York, Miami was really in trouble.
Yeah. So what did you find in Miami?
Well, the first thing I found in Miami was, you know, water up to my knees at a high tide. You know, I was walking through an area of Miami Beach called Sunset Harbor, which is one of the sort of up and coming hot areas. And it was king tides, you know, the time of year when the normal high tides are especially high, and the streets were flooding hugely. I mean, I was literally walking through, you know, knee high, you know, seawater on the streets where you had $10 million condos. And it didn't take me a whole lot of time to think about the implications of this. You know, Miami-Dade County, 70% of Miami-Dade County is less than 6 feet above sea level. There's no basically high ground to retreat to. You have a huge amount of incredibly valuable real estate right on the water, as everyone knows. It's sitting right there at water's edge. And finally, you have this whole thing built on a kind of porous limestone that means that you can't build seawalls and traditional defenses in the way you can, say, in New York or in the Netherlands or a place like that, because the water will go right underneath. So I was there for, basically a week talking to scientists and others, and it became clear to me that Miami was the Miami as we know it today, the city that we know and love, is doomed in a world of rapidly rising seas. And that was really the beginning of the book. I wrote a Rolling Stone story called Goodbye Miami that attracted a lot of attention, and I realized that this was a hugely important story to tell that no one had really looked into in the full economic and political and kind of cultural complexities of what sea level rise means to how we live.
Yeah, and so talk a little bit about some of those political, economic, and cultural complexities. I was really struck by the attitude of the real estate industry.
Yeah, the real estate industry, especially in Florida, is. I wrote a previous book about the coal industry and spent a lot of time in West Virginia with coal miners and talked to them about climate change. And of course, a lot of them don't exactly embrace climate science, but none of them are as ferocious of a deniers as the Miami real estate people that I met. I mean, they really, do not want to believe that this is real and are doing everything they can to, kind of keep it out of the conversation, because there's a great fear, in South Florida, because real estate is basically the real estate and tourism are the economic engines of the state. And, if you take sea level rise seriously and you think seriously about what the implications are, then it's the implications for real estate prices and property values are frightening. And county and city and state officials that I've talked to are very concerned about this. They all know that, once property values start to decline and people start to realize that the flooding that they're seeing there already is just going to get worse and worse and worse. People start deciding to sell their houses, to move away. Property values go down at exactly the same time as it's costing cities and states more and more to replenish the sand on beaches and stop the erosion on roads. So just as the cost of sort of defending from sea level rise are going up, property values and revenues are going down, and it becomes this sort of really downward economic spiral for a lot of coastal cities that is very, very concerning.
In fact, you talk about a winning scenario and a losing scenario in terms of Miami. Explain.
So there's ways of thinking about how you could manage this, obvious reality. I mean, one important point to make about sea level rise is that it's going to happen. Even if we cut carbon emissions to zero, everybody rides skateboards to work, we're still going to see significant amount of sea level rise because of the heat that's already built up in the ocean. So we know this is going to happen. So the sort of winning scenario for this is to begin, serious preparations for this for a place like South Florida, which means changing building codes dramatically, requiring all buildings to be higher, beginning to end development in low areas that are obviously going to be flooded very soon, moving real estate. There are a couple of higher places in Miami, moving development to those higher spots, doing things like thinking about relocating the airport to somewhere where it has a chance of operating with higher waters. Right now, it's very vulnerable. And beginning what scientists, social scientists, and others call a kind of managed retreat from the risky areas. And it's possible to do that, even in a place like Miami, to make the impacts sort of less profound than they might be otherwise. So that's the winning scenario for there. For the losing scenario, it's just, head in the sand denial. This is not happening. This is not happening. And what happens then is I think that you get something like a subprime real estate meltdown, a collapse, when all of a sudden people realize that this is real. Property values fall very quickly. The residents and others realize that, the city and state is doing nothing to prepare for this, which, even causes the prices to plummet even more. And you get into a real kind of economic catastrophe for South Florida. And I think that that's very possible also.
It's interesting what you lay out there. I'm doing the interview right now is on the east end of Long Island. And last spring, we had a presentation that the town had hired a consulting firm to give us about the impact of sea level rise. And it showed a huge loss in property values. But one thing that really worried me was that what they were presenting was based on a projection of 6 feet of sea level rise by the end of the century. You just mentioned 9 feet. I've read Jim Hansen and others that say it could be as much as 21 feet or even higher. It just seems that each time, you know, that we look more and more closely at this, the projections get worse. So talk about the science of sea level rise and what are some realistic assumptions that planners could make if they even were planning for it?
Yeah, so that's a really good question. So first of all, I would say that I think that, you know, what we're looking at for a high end by 2100 is, you know, plausibly 6, 7, 8 feet maybe. That would be the high end. And near term, you know, by 2050, we could see even a foot and a half or 2 feet. But these numbers are all over the place, mostly because ice dynamics are really complex. And sea level rise is basically, you know, about two things. One, the melting of Greenland and the melting of Antarctica. There are other factors like thermal expansion of the oceans and mountain glaciers and all kinds of other stuff, but they're really not big contributors. The major question is Greenland and Antarctica. And in the last decade or so, scientists have been, you know, working really hard to try to understand the dynamics of what's happening up there. And to grossly oversimplify this, the profound thing that they've figured out is that these big ice cubes, these ice sheets at the top and the bottom of the planet, you know, they can melt at a certain rate, but they can collapse even faster, these ice sheets. And one of the things that's happening in West Antarctica, which is a place of big concern, and one of the reasons why these numbers keep getting bigger, is they're figuring out that for a lot of complicated reasons, West Antarctica in particular could collapse into the sea relatively quickly and put a whole lot of ice into the Southern Ocean very fast. And there's some evidence that might be sort of a process that's in the works right now. Scientists know from studying the past that there have been these moments of big pulses of sea level rise. Sea level rise doesn't happen in a smooth sort of exponential kind of curve. It happens in these big pulses. And they think that West Antarctica might be one of the mechanisms that has caused that in the past and could cause it again. So these projections are at the mercy of sort of basically our understanding of ice sheet dynamics. And what's really important and most alarming is that, you know, in the last decade or even two decades, all the numbers are progressively getting higher. The error bars are going towards higher and higher, not towards lower and lower. So the risks are getting greater and greater the more they understand how this all works. And then how you deal with that is, you know, the really hard question. It would be one thing if, you know, we knew, there's going to be 3 feet of sea level rise by 2075. So we can all build our houses and do what we need to do and figure out our planning for our roads and our bridges and everything, because we know that's what we're going to be facing. We don't. We have to plan for a real uncertainty. You know, we could see 3 feet by 2075. We could see 3 feet of sea level rise by 2050 or 2060, the way things are going. So how do you deal with that uncertainty? And that's the hard question for coastal engineers, for people who are concerned about this, developers and others, and also politically for the strategy of how do you handle this? What do you do? But just to add one last thought to this, you know, we plan in uncertainty all the time. We just don't think about it that way. But I mean, one great example is, you know, after 9/11, we knew that there were a terrorist threat to America. We didn't know how great that threat is. We still don't know how great it is. But there are things that we do, kind of common sense steps to make ourselves safer. And some people would say, of course, that President Trump goes too far on certain things. But there are things we can do, even though we don't know exactly what the threat is. It's the same thing with sea level rise. There's a lot of things we could do and that we're not doing, even though there is this great uncertainty about what the sort of amount and speed of rise might be.
And when you say what we could be doing, you're not talking necessarily about cutting carbon emissions. I mean, clearly that's part of the scenario. You're talking more specifically about planning for adaptation.
Right. I mean, cutting carbon emissions, I need to be very clear, is hugely important for sea level rise. It could reduce the risk of places like West Antarctica hitting a tipping point and kind of collapsing. And it would certainly, in the long run, reduce the level of sea level rise we get. But in the short term, it's not going to have a big impact on sea level rise. But it's hugely important for many, many, many other reasons that I'm sure all your listeners understand. But no, the thing that I think that we need to do is, kind of have two conversations going on simultaneously. One is, how do we cut carbon as fast as possible? And the other one is, how do we adapt to this new world of rising seas that we know now is going to happen? And, you look at some of the insane building that's going on in coastal areas. I mean, Miami, North Carolina, even New York. I mean, people are still building as if, this border between land and sea is like forever fixed where it is. And it's, if there's one thing we know, it's that that's not true.
And everyone wants to have waterfront views.
They do. We love water. People love to live on water.
If you've just joined Writer's Voice, we're talking about sea level rise now and in this century with Jeff Goodell. His book is The Water Will Come: Rising Seas, Sinking Cities, and the Remaking of the Civilized World. It was a New York Times critic's top book of 2017. So, also, talk about sea level rise and income inequality, not just abroad, but here at home. You give an example of Sweetwater, Florida, that I found very interesting. Tell us about that.
Yeah, so I mean, this is one of the things that I'm sort of most concerned about, and when I think about the impacts of this for the in the near term, not just in the far future, but in the next decade or so, is that there are a lot of people who live in coastal areas who, it's their second home or something like that. Miami is a, textbook example of that. A lot of people own real estate in Miami just for investment purposes. The occupancy rate for condos in Miami Beach is like 10%. I mean, there's a lot of foreign money that's just parked there. There's a lot of second homes. And these people who have this investments there, I'm not so concerned about. I mean, they can often either, sell, and if they have to take a hit on their property values a little bit, that's fine. They move off to somewhere else. And people who have wealth can deal with this. They can just leave and or absorb whatever modest losses they might take. But it's people like Sweetwater, which is a community that's sort of inland from the coast, and it's maybe 5 miles from the Atlantic Ocean. You would think, oh, this is and it's a largely Hispanic and Cuban neighborhood, and you would think, oh, this is not at risk, but in fact, it's hugely at risk because in Florida, the water will come in from both sides, from the Everglades flooding and from the ocean side. So Sweetwater is, in fact, kind of more at risk than a lot of the places on the coast. But people there don't know it, and they have their working class people, many of them. I spent a lot of time there talking to residents, and they have their entire life savings in their home. It's this sort of American dream idea. I've worked 30 years as a car mechanic, and I've saved, and I have this beautiful house that I love very much. And it's very kind of heartbreaking to look at them and to say, well, have you thought about the fact that, in 10 years, your house could be worth half as much because, the flooding that you're seeing now on rainy days is just going to get worse and worse. And the water's going to start coming in from the Everglades, and there's not much anyone can do about that, and it's going to hurt your property values. And for them, people like that, that's just devastating. And it's just it kind of broke my heart talking to a lot of these people.
And you envision a kind of disaster capitalism scenario taking over with rich speculators making out like bandits, snapping up these properties of the poor and then turning them into more resilient high-end condos.
Yeah, I mean, I think that that's already starting to play out in places, and it's not just low-income areas that will be true, but also I've seen this going on already with historic structures, places that are designated historic landmarks or in historic districts or for other reasons have been off limits to developers. Developers are now moving into those areas and talking to city councils and things and saying, look, you know, these houses are low. They're not worth much. They're going to be flooded. Let me buy it up, tear it down, and I will build you, you know, a new condo tower or whatever. And it'll be, you know, 8 feet off the ground and it'll be more resilient and the property values will triple and, you know, we'll all be happy. Except, of course, you know, A, the people who already live there will not be happy. It's a kind of disaster capitalism, gentrification of these areas. And second, you know, raising a structure is not really a solution to this. I mean, it's a solution for that particular building, but it doesn't help with the larger problems of flooded infrastructure. And it doesn't matter if your building is 10 feet off the ground if the roads getting to your house are all flooded. So it doesn't really solve the problem.
And so now, what about New York City? One of your sources said that climate science fundamentally calls into question New York's very existence. And yet, as you point out, New York is responsible for nearly 10% of the U.S. GDP. So it's likely to be one of the places that we're going to try to save, at least initially. And one of the plans is the Big U, which I think was supposed to be much further along right now than it actually is. I think it's barely started. But explain the Big U and then tell us what you think about it.
Yeah, so after Hurricane Sandy, there was, you know, a lot of interest in, you know, changing and making New York City more resilient. And it was a big wake-up call, just as it was for me, to city planners and others there and to the future of New York City. And so they had a design competition that was funded by HUD, Housing and Urban Development Agency. And long story short, they awarded six innovative projects to vulnerable areas. And the biggest sort of poster child for this whole thing was called the Big U, which is essentially what it sounds like, which is a big U-shaped barrier around Lower Manhattan, roughly from 45th Street to 45th Street on each side. And it was designed by a consortium of architects led by Bjarke Ingels, the very famous Danish architect. And it's really a kind of stylish thing. You know, they don't even like to be called a wall. They like to call it a barrier with amenities. So it has, you know, kind of park-like, you know, grassy knolls and places for playing sports. And it's a kind of, I'm almost imagining it like a kind of Central Park-y kind of band around Lower Manhattan. That's ideally what it would be. In reality, who knows what it'll actually look like, because, you know, right now the price tag is roughly $8 billion, but who knows what that will actually be. And as we know, building any kind of infrastructure in New York is incredibly complicated. You know, it took, 70 years to build a new subway line?
I think it was 100.
Yeah, something like that. So, you know, I mean, it's one thing to have a design competition and have Bjarke Ingels come up with a really cool idea for how you protect Lower Manhattan. It's a whole other thing to raise the money, the rest of the money, and actually get it done. So New York City is, in some senses, very lucky. It has a lot of money. You know, Lower Manhattan is the most valuable real estate in the world. I can't imagine that they will not figure out some way to protect Lower Manhattan. And the Big U is one example of that. And if exactly the one that is imagined is not built, something I'm sure will be built there to protect Lower Manhattan. But New York is also lucky because there's a lot of high ground. You know, everything from, you know, Washington Heights out in Queens is a lot of high ground. And there's a lot of, you know, a lot of people thinking very progressively about it there now. I mean, there's a lot of, I would say, sort of intellectually in processing what has to be done. I think New York City is probably one of the leaders in the country on this. But the problem is that it's also a huge, huge problem for New York because you have, you know, a lot of built infrastructure in low places, in, you know, neighborhoods like Howard Beach and South Brooklyn that are incredibly vulnerable. And there's no real simple way to elevate or protect those areas, the Rockaways, Jamaica Bay, all of that. Across the Hudson, you have Newark and Hoboken, all of which are very vulnerable also. And then you have the things like the subways. You know, the subways were out of service for several years, a couple of the lines, as a result of Hurricane Sandy. And, you know, it's just a small amount of seawater getting into the subway tunnels is devastating. They weren't built for seawater inundation in any way. So how you do things like protect the subways and stuff is hugely complicated. You have major airports like LaGuardia and JFK, for that matter, that are very low and very vulnerable to small amounts of sea level rise. So it's got a lot of virtues in the sense of brain power thinking about it and money, but it's also got a lot of problems.
This is Writer's Voice, and I'm Francesca Rhiannon. I'm talking with journalist Jeff Goodell about sea level rise. His book is The Water Will Come, Rising Seas, Sinking Cities, and the Remaking of the Civilized World. Some of the most innovative thinking is being done in New York City. One of the things you talk about in this book, and I think an example of it is in the New York chapter, is living with the water, not fighting it, working with nature. So just as a brief example, tell us about Kate Orff and Living Breakwaters.
So Living Breakwaters is a really innovative idea that was one of the six ideas from this Resilient by Design competition that I mentioned that the Big U was part of. And Kate's really, she just got a MacArthur Genius Grant this year. You know, she's a really innovative thinker. And, you know, I think I'm correct in paraphrasing her and saying that, you know, she thinks that the whole idea of sort of walls and keeping out water is like a old idea. It's not going to work in a world of rapidly rising seas. The Dutch believe that also. They have this whole notion now of living with water and how do you live with water? And because they realize that, you know, building walls is ultimately foolish in a world when you have quickly rising seas. And so this project, the Breakwater Project on Staten Island that she's designed, is actually designed as a way to bring people back to the water. Instead of building walls to keep people away from the shore, it's like, how do we make it safe for people to be with the water and near the water again? So it's a sort of engineered breakwater off the coast, like you've seen, people are familiar with breakwaters. They're like piles of riprap or stone, you know, that absorb the energy from the waves. But this one is particularly innovative in its design, in that it's designed to attract animals, sea life, oysters, all kinds of things. And it's particularly sort of artfully placed so that there's, you know, kind of safe areas and for people to swim and launch their kayaks and be out in the water. The idea is it's not a solution for sea level rise because it doesn't stop the water, but it allows there to be a kind of safe interim zone between where the waves come in and where the real damage is done and where people can live and be. And this idea of encouraging people to see water not as a threat, but as something that if you deal with it in the right way, it's a very lovely to be around. And so there's a big conceptual leap that is sort of brilliant in that work that she's doing.
So then another kind of engineering solutions, geoengineering, you talk about in the book. And in fact, I just this week was reading Elizabeth Culbert's article in The New Yorker about sucking carbon out of the atmosphere, whether that's something that's feasible. You talk about another kind of geoengineering, putting sulfur dioxide into the atmosphere. Tell us about that and also put it into the context of kind of the pros and cons of geoengineering.
Yeah, so my previous book was actually about this. It was called How to Cool the Planet. And it came out of my understanding that after I had written about fossil fuel industry a lot, that we really weren't going to get off fossil fuels and anytime soon, or certainly not soon enough to mitigate the, you know, impacts of climate change, and that we were going to be moving into a world of a rapidly changing climate, and what were we going to do about it? And one of the tools or technological fixes that a small band of scientists, you know, a decade ago were starting to talk about and are talking about increasingly now, was if you needed to cool things off quickly, you know, what could you do? If we got into a world where we knew that the ice sheets were rapidly melting and we were going to face a future of rapid sea level rise, it would be devastating for coastal cities all around the world. Is there anything theoretically that one could do? And the answer is yes, there is something. And it's this thing called geoengineering, in particular solar geoengineering, which is basically a way of kind of mimicking volcanoes. We know that when there's major volcanic eruptions like Mount Pinatubo in 1992, it puts a lot of dust particles high up into the stratosphere. And those little dust particles act as little reflectors. And they reflect away a small amount of the sunlight, 1 or 2% of the sunlight. But even a small amount of sunlight reflected away can lower the temperature on the planet significantly. Like Mount Pinatubo lowered the temperature for like 2 years, a year and a half, almost 2 degrees. And that's a lot. So the idea is that you could use traditional jets that we already have that put them up, fly them up into the stratosphere and spray sulfate particles into the stratosphere, and essentially putting up this sort of haze of reflectors into the stratosphere that reflects away a little bit of sunlight and could slow the melt from the ice sheets. No one is doing this yet. I mean, this is not real yet, but there's been a lot of modeling that shows that it, in theory, could work to slow the ice melt and to cool the planet. But there's a lot. It's a very scary scenario for a number of reasons that are pretty obvious. One is that you're messing with the climate system, and no one is really sure what impact that will have on the position of the jet stream, which could change monsoon patterns, and you're starting to muck with the big levers of the climate system. It also doesn't do anything to deal with some of the other real problems of too much carbon in the atmosphere, such as ocean acidification and things like that, which are very bad. And ultimately, it can slow the ice sheets down, but it's not going to stop sea level rise because of the, as I mentioned before, the heat that's already built up in the oceans. But, I've been thinking about this for 10 years now, basically, since I first heard about it. And I've been watching it gain legitimacy and becoming more and more part of the conversation. And I'm actually glad for that, because I think that we need to have some really good scientists, and there are some really good scientists who are thinking about this, to really find out what the dangers and risks are and what the possibility is, because I think someone's going to do it. And it doesn't require a whole lot of money. Bill Gates could do it himself if he wanted to. 10 billionaires in China could band together and decided they want to do this. It's a very low cost, comparatively, thing to do. And I think that we're going to rapidly move into a place when someone, for good reasons or bad, is going to consider doing something like this. And the more we know about it, the better.
Well, Jeff Goodell, you've written a book about coal. You've written a book about geoengineering. Now this book, The Water Will Come, about sea level rise. And I'm so glad that you joined us here to talk about it. I think it's a very important book, The Water Will Come, Rising Seas, Sinking Cities, and the Remaking of the Civilized World. Jeff Goodell, thanks so much for joining us here.
Thank you so much for having me.
Jeff Goodell writes for Rolling Stone magazine and is a fellow at the New America Foundation. His previous books include Big Coal and How to Cool the Planet. The Water Will Come is published by Little Brown. Go to writersvoice.net to read more by Jeff Goodell. You'll also find our web-only interview with scientist Robert Kopp about his new report, Doubling Official Sea Level Rise Predictions by the End of the Century. Next up, climate change lawsuits. Stay tuned after the break. Welcome back to Writer's Voice. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. Only 90 companies are responsible for half of all climate change. How long will it take before the world starts holding them accountable in court? Well, it's already happening. No suits have yet been won, but it took a long while before big tobacco started losing big in court, and many predict big dirty energy will follow suit. Climate Liability News is the website to go to for reporting on the intersection of climate change impacts and the law. Like Inside Climate News, ProPublica, and Tarbell, it's a nonprofit journalism site. And I'm very pleased to welcome its founding editor, Lynn Zinser, to Writer's Voice.
Thanks for having me.
So, how much climate change litigation is happening in the U.S. and around the world now?
Well, it's still a relatively small group of suits, but it is certainly growing. And I think that a lot of people foresee more things on the horizon. Certainly, the cases that were filed by California communities this summer are very much a bellwether event, because what is going to be happening is, as climate impacts become much harder to pay for as time goes along, they're getting more expensive, they're getting more common. Communities are having trouble figuring out how on earth this is going to get paid for. And the more cities that file suits such as that, trying to hold the fossil fuel industry accountable, that certainly has to get attention of more communities across the country and around the world. So I would say it's still a relatively limited field, but it could change very quickly, because as these costs escalate, there become fewer and fewer places to turn for how to pay for them.
And what are some of the legal doctrines being used for these suits? I mean, we'll go into some particular ones, but maybe just give us a brief overview before we go into some examples.
Well, the one that gets the most attention right now is certainly the doctrine being pursued by Juliana versus the United States, the 21 kids suing the federal government for promoting fossil fuel policies that aggravate climate change, which they argue violates their right to life, liberty, and property in the future, and also a constitutional right, or they would like to see a constitutional right to a safe climate. That is based on a public trust doctrine, whereas, and it's really a legal doctrine that's not new, it's actually very, very old, that a government is responsible for preserving resources for, you know, for future generations' use, and in this case, resources being a livable climate and a safe environment. So that is the basis of that case. That is used in a lot of places around the world. And in many countries, they actually have constitutions that guarantee the health of their citizenry. Our constitution does not explicitly delineate that. So they're trying to sort of create a new little niche. Based on a doctrine, though, it is a legal doctrine that is old and well-respected, the public trust doctrine, trying to use it in a kind of a novel way. And then, you know, there's just a much more straightforward liability claims. The fact that science is now proving how much of global warming has been driven by the burning of fossil fuels over the course of the industrial time. And as they get the science more and more specific about how much and exactly how much has been driven, the fact that climate change impacts are costly, they are just using a direct cause and effect. Well, if these companies caused these impacts, they should pay for the damages. So that's, you know, just much more along the line of just a strict cause and effect climate liability claim.
The first one that you mentioned, it is certainly probably one of the most important suits, one of the ones at least more people may know about, the one of these 21 young people. I believe it was begun by a young man who was 13 when he started. Now, the Trump administration lawyer on the case is saying that it should not be allowed to proceed because it would disturb the separation of powers as laid out in the Constitution. So explain to us what the opposition is and kind of, you know, where the suit is right now.
Well, right now it is waiting for the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals to decide whether it goes ahead to its scheduled trial date. The U.S. District Court in Oregon scheduled a trial for February. The Trump administration is trying to derail that as much as possible, tried to dismiss, and that was turned down. So they filed for something called a writ of mandamus, which is a very extraordinary legal move, asking a higher court to dismiss a case or to take a case off before a verdict has been rendered. Now, you have to show something pretty special to get that kind of an order from a higher court. And they just had a hearing last week. The Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals judges seemed very skeptical that this case, there was enough of a reason to derail it before a trial. So we are waiting for the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals decision from last week's hearing of whether the case goes ahead to its scheduled trial or grants the Trump administration argument that it should not go ahead. So the argument that the assistant district attorney made at the hearing was that basically, this is not an area for the courts to decide, that this is an area that should be dealt with by the executive and legislative branch. That's who makes policy in this country. And that for the courts to come in and dictate policy is the wrong way to go. So that was his argument. But again, to get what they're requesting right now, which is to derail a case that a U.S. District Court has judged should go ahead, to get that off the rails for some extraordinary circumstances, you know, that is considered a long shot to get a panel of judges to agree to that. So we're waiting for that ruling. I think most people expect that that panel will send this forward to its trial. So I don't know at this point, timing-wise, how long all this is going to take and whether or not a February trial is still feasible, but we're still waiting for that ruling.
Now, another really important suit that did not go forward was Kivalina versus ExxonMobil. This is a case of a small Alaskan town near the Arctic Circle, which is being progressively, its land is being chipped away by sea level rise. Tell us a little bit about that suit and why did it fail?
Well, it failed because the judges in that case ruled that because they filed in federal court and the body responsible for environmental regulation in this country and climate protection is the Environmental Protection Agency. And so that their responsibility for regulating greenhouse gases and the environment in this country trumps any liability claim against any one particular corporate actor. So that was the decision in that case. It influences a lot of future cases in that some of these current cases, particularly the ones in California, are trying to fight these cases in state courts instead of federal courts so that Kivalina doesn't apply in the state court. So that was the precedent that that case created, and it certainly slowed down the ability to pursue these cases in federal court. Of course, times have changed since that ruling, and the Environmental Protection Agency could certainly be accused of not pursuing its legal responsibility for protecting the climate and environment right now. But nobody has brought that case, so certainly that could be coming in the future.
Not yet. I mean, we do have some states that are taking some pretty active action, well, states and localities. Well, first, you've mentioned the California cases a couple of times. These seem to involve the public nuisance law, usually applied to things like, you know, loitering. Tell us about these cases and why they're so important.
Well, they're very important because it's a demonstrated legal avenue, the same legal avenue where California, for instance, holding companies accountable for lead content in paint. That was a public health problem that the suit was brought in California court to address the lead content in paint and the fact that it was harming people and children. Along those lines, using the same line of thinking, if a company is producing a dangerous product, knows it's dangerous, and continues to sell it and contribute to the, you know, public health threat, then that company should be held accountable. So it's the same. It's along the same lines. It's the community saying the fossil fuel industry has known for decades that their products contribute to global warming in a significant fashion, continue to sell them, and not only just continue to sell them, but have worked pretty publicly to cast doubt on the science of climate science that their products do contribute to global warming, have worked actively against any kind of climate policy to decrease fossil fuel emissions. So that's part of their argument, too, is not just that they sell these products, but that they've known the dangers and have actually worked against any solutions to those dangers and actively worked against those solutions. So that's, again, using kind of that same, you know, harm and effect line of thinking like you would use for any public health threat, including tobacco, like I said, and lead paint and those kinds of things. So that's certainly the line of thinking of those suits. And there is more and more science that can tie each company or a set of companies to how much global warming they have produced. So that's sort of what is helping these cases, because before it's like, well, yeah, it's happening, but how much is Exxon responsible? You can't really tell, can you? But now that there's science that actually is, you can tie their products and how much has been burned over the years to the global warming that has caused. So that is some of the basis for some of these suits now. They feel like they have much more scientific basis to base these claims on.
And we should point out for our listeners that nearly half of modern global warming has been linked to 90 companies. So is that from the kind of research you're talking about?
Yeah, that's exactly the research. They're called the carbon majors, the 90 primary fossil fuel companies around the world driving, like you said, half of modern global warming. So those numbers have gotten more specific over the years, and in two of the cases in California, the San Francisco and Oakland cases, they're actually just targeting five of the largest. So, you know, they're even whittling things down even further. But yes, it is 90 companies that have been identified as what they call the carbon majors. So that's the significant research that that these cases are leaning on.
And if you've just joined Writer's Voice, we're talking with Lynn Zinser of Climate Liability News. She is the founding editor of that website. Now, the Exxon suit, you mentioned that. Tell us about that suit. And also, I mean, this is a suit that a number of different states' AGs have come together to pursue. New York is included. Massachusetts is included. Tell us about it.
Yeah, that stemmed from in my last job. I used to work for Inside Climate News, another nonprofit journalism organization in the same space, and a few years ago produced a pretty major investigation showing Exxon's history of pursuing climate, serious climate science, as far back as the 1960s. Actually, we targeted specifically 70s, but then found more documents that take the whole fossil fuel industry back early into the 60s, so understanding the science of global warming and their products and the effect that they were going to have on the future climate, and the fact that they then, along the way, decided instead to cast doubt on the very science that they did themselves and worked very hard against any kind of policies on every level to deal with the problem. So that investigation came out, and Eric Schneiderman, the Attorney General of New York, says he had already had this on his mind for quite a while, that the major fossil fuel companies were potentially guilty of fraud, not just against the public, but also against investors investing in their companies. So he subpoenaed documents and launched a major investigation. At the time, a whole bunch of states got together and said, yes, we're all in on this. But as it turned out, Massachusetts, with Maura Healey, jumped in with her investigation. The U.S. Virgin Islands, of all places, also jumped in with some subpoenas. But Exxon fought back and fought back hard, which is its history. They invest in a lot of lawyers to fight absolutely everything. If you look back at the history of how long and hard they fought just paying for the impacts of the Exxon Valdez disaster, you'll understand their strategy of fighting everything tooth and nail. And so the Virgin Islands ended up backing out of the suit. They don't have the kind of resources, I believe, it takes to sustain an extended legal fight with Exxon. And then I think that sort of sent a little scare among the rest of the states that realized this is going to be long and hard. And they pretty much let New York and Massachusetts take the lead. The notable admission to that group is California, which people thought would be a natural to join in that suit. And it's been, we actually wrote a story about this, of like, why hasn't California joined? And there's not really a good answer for it. I think that one of the theories is they're waiting for New York and Massachusetts to do the hard stuff, and then they will jump in at some point. So that's where that is. That is going to be a protracted legal standoff. Exxon fights every step of document requests and such. So I'm sure that will take a while to come to fruition, but it is still proceeding. And both of those attorney general have been very diligent in fighting not just this, but many, many of the Trump administration policies, including, you know, Clean Air Act violations, et cetera. So they're kind of at the forefront of resisting the trend against environmental protection and climate protection.
Another liability issue Climate Liability News has reported on is credit ratings. Moody's is now warning state and city governments that their credit ratings will tumble if they fail to begin adapting to the effects of climate change. Tell us more about that.
Yeah, that was a very interesting move for them to announce that. It's, clearly these costs are escalating. You don't have to look any farther than places like Houston or California for what's happening and the constant battle of how it's going to get paid for. basically they're saying if we don't come up with a, you know, proactive way of dealing with these costs, it's going to affect cities' credit ratings. So everybody took that and said, okay, that's interesting. And most people think nothing will actually happen until they actually downgrade a city's credit, which they've warned, but nobody's actually been downgraded. So it hasn't translated into reality yet. It was just a warning. So I'm not sure it's really going to get anybody's attention until somebody's credit actually takes a hit.
And it would take a hit precisely because as coastal properties go underwater or the values of the properties plummet, property taxes are going to go down. And so at the same time that the costs are escalating, the revenues are declining.
Right. And, you know, not just the property values going down, but just population loss of people moving away from the coast as well. So, you know, your tax base is shrinking. We had some figures in that story about New Jersey and a percentage of the tax base lost after Hurricane Sandy, you know, and those numbers were pretty significant. So, yeah, you're going to lose revenues. And then if your credit rating gets downgraded, you have less of an ability as a municipality to issue bonds and raise money that way. And, you know, the aggravating factor for these communities is the fact that clearly the federal government is not proactively thinking about how to help. And even simple things like the guidelines for building in flood zones that the Obama administration attempted to strengthen and make people think harder and further in advance about sea level rise and climate impacts, you know, are being rolled back under the current administration. So the idea that, okay, the federal government will always be the fail-safe is a shakier idea these days.
So would it behoove municipalities and states to actually sue on this basis of having lost, you know, been downgraded in their credit rating and having property tax losses?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, that was one of the points of the story that we wrote is that, you know, as these avenues are taken away to deal with the problem, you know, people are going to have to get creative in thinking about how they are actually going to deal with this. It's very interesting because, you know, it has become, bizarrely, over the years, a political issue where Democrats generally believe in climate change and Republicans claim it's not that much of a problem. But in a place like Miami, they have a Republican mayor who lobbied successfully for a climate adaptation plan that involved raising taxes on the community, and they actually voted that through, which is pretty remarkable on all sides. But at some point, taxpayers are going to stop and say, why do we keep paying for this? Who caused this? You know, why is this such a problem? So I don't think just keeping raising taxes on people is going to be the answer of how this all gets paid for.
Lynn Zinser is the founding editor of Climate Liability News. Before that, she was with Inside Climate News, where she worked on the Pulitzer Prize-winning report on Exxon's early research proving climate change, which the company later abandoned and covered up. Go to writersvoice.net for a link to the latest on climate liability news. And if you're listening to this podcast, please rate us on iTunes or whichever podcast app you're using. It really helps to get the word out about this show. Thanks. That's it this week for Writer's Voice. Go to writersvoice.net to listen to or download past shows, plus find out more about our guests or read book excerpts. You can also sign up to get the show delivered straight to your inbox or subscribe to the free podcast and newsletter. I'm your host, Francesca Rhiannon.